Hello, welcome to Entertainment Weekly. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and every week I read from Entertainment Weekly's website, which is EW.com. We have many different articles. I don't have a general theme, but I do have many articles from the website, and let's get started. First, I'm reading from their must list, Dead Boy Detectives, Challengers, and Baby Reindeer top this week's must list. These are Entertainment Weekly's top pop culture picks for the week, and this is by the Entertainment Weekly staff. I swear, this weekly letter wasn't intended to be so musical focused, but I've just been wowed by my recent trips to the theater. This past week, I caught the national tour of Funny Girl. The Broadway production was all about the Beanie Feldstein replaced by Lea Michele drama, but at Center Theater Troupe's Amazon Theater in Los Angeles, it's all about Katrina McCrimmon. The recent college grad has the clearest voice I've heard in ages, with charisma to spare. Remember her name, I'll bet that you'll be saying it at the awards shows in coming years. And Melissa Manchester plays her mom for Not Crying Out Loud. That was Patrick Gomez, editor-in-chief. So on their list is Dead Boy Detectives. With the glory days of the CW behind us, where's one supposed to find a new supernatural procedural to obsess over? Netflix has your answer with this new series, which stars George Rexdrew and Jaden Reverie as undead sleuths who help other ghosts solve their problems. Not only is the chemistry crackling between the leads and their allies, including Cassius Nelson's psychic Crystal Palace, but the magical rules are detailed enough, don't use spells on cats or face the consequences, to make this world feel textured and lived in. Fans of The Sandman, Supernatural, and Arrow shouldn't miss this one. The movie Challengers. In Challengers, sex is a tennis match, and tennis is everything. Over a decade, professional tennis players Tashi, played by Zendaya, Art, played by Mike Feist, and Patrick, played by Josh O'Connor, tangle a web of desire and competition. It's game, set, match for the best movie of the year so far. Cabaret at the Kit Kat Club. Willkommen, bienvenue. Welcome to the hottest show on Broadway. The jaw-dropping revival delivered in the round at the August Wilson Theater features awards-worthy Eddie Redmayne and Gail Rankin as the stars of a Berlin nightclub amid the Nazis' rise to power. And then we have Baby Reindeer. Richard Gadd has bravely turned his own harrowing experiences into this powerful and unsettling Netflix limited series. Of its stellar cast, Jessica Gunning stands out as a troubled stalker named Martha Scott, with a performance that showcases a versatility we typically see across an entire career. And last, it's Waxahachie on tour. Singer-songwriter Katie Crutchfield followed up her 2020 masterpiece, St. Cloud, one of the most life-affirming albums released during the pandemic, with the similarly rocking Tiger's Blood, and her music comes alive on stage with a full band. Expect the crowds to be packed and joyous. That was Dead Boy Detectives, Challengers, and Baby Reindeer top this week's must list, and it was by the Entertainment Weekly staff. So we heard about Dead Boy Detectives, and here's another article about that. See Lucas Gage as a horny cat king in Dead Boy Detectives. Get ready for Netflix's new paranormal mystery series. This is by Christian Haloub. Lucas Gage has played many roles in movies and TV shows over the past few years, but trust us when we say you've never seen him like this. In this article, they have a clip from the Dead Boy Detectives series, and in it, Gage manifests as the Cat King, a supernatural being who can shapeshift between human and cat forms. He's angry at protagonists Edwin Payne, played by George Rexdrew, and Charles Roland, played by Jaden Reverie, for using a spell on another cat, something that is forbidden in this magical world. "We should discuss your offense privately," the Cat King tells Edwin, sounding more than a little seductive. The show is based on the DC Comics characters of the same name, who were originally created by Neil Gaiman and Matt Wagner in an issue of The Sandman. In that issue, dead people across the world had magically returned to Earth after a regime change in Hell. But even after the natural order was restored by Dream and Death, Edwin and Charles were able to maintain their undead status and became detectives. The show, which may or may not be directly connected to Netflix's adaptation of The Sandman, stay tuned to Entertainment Weekly for more information on that, runs with the premise of Edwin and Charles as living ghosts who use their supernatural skills to help citizens of London solve mysteries and other paranormal problems. Cassius Nelson also stars as Crystal Palace, a living woman who becomes entangled with the Dead Boy Detectives agency. She's a little newer to the world of magic than Edwin or Charles, but to find out how exactly she's connected to them and what Edwin will need to do to placate the Cat King, you have to watch Dead Boy Detectives, and it premiered on April 25th on Netflix. That was a bit of a preview about Dead Boy Detectives, and it was by Christian Huloub. This was the front page article when I opened up the website today. Ellen DeGeneres addresses aftermath of toxic workplace claims. It's hard to dance when you're crying. This is by Emlyn Travis. Ellen DeGeneres might be able to joke now about the events that led to the end of her talk show, but that doesn't mean it didn't take an emotional toll on her. The comedian reflected on her experience getting kicked out of show business for being mean during her latest stand-up comedy gig at the Largo in Los Angeles on Wednesday, reports People. She made her cracks in reference to a 2020 BuzzFeed News report in which several Ellen DeGeneres show staffers anonymously came forward with toxic workplace environment claims, saying they'd experienced racial microaggressions and were punished for taking medical or bereavement leave while employed by the talk show. "The hate went on for a long time, and I would try to avoid looking at the news," she told the crowd, multiple outlets report. "The Be Kind Girl wasn't kind. That was the headline." DeGeneres added that her decision to end each episode of the show by reminding viewers to be kind to one another slowly became a problem because the public began to perceive her as a one-dimensional character who gave stuff away and danced up steps. At the end of her routine, DeGeneres held a Q&A session during which a fan asked if she was still able to dance through the backlash. "No, it's hard to dance when you're crying," she admitted, adding that she had a hard time and didn't get out much during the height of the controversy. DeGeneres explained that the scandal left her in a funk that also had an effect on her wife, Portia de Rossi. "She was watching it happen to me," the comedian recalled. "She went through it with me." Though the couple overcame the media storm together and are both dancing now, she lost her desire to continue with her career. Said DeGeneres, "I'm making jokes about what happened to me, but it was devastating. It took a long time for me to want to do anything again." She also acknowledged that she hated the way the show ended because she loved it so much. In the aftermath of the allegations, which resulted in a large viewership fallout, the show's parent company, Warner Media, launched an internal investigation and found deficiencies in how the series was run. The talk show later parted ways with three producers. DeGeneres repeatedly apologized to her staff and offered them new perks following the report. However, in 2021, she announced that the series would end in 2022 after 19 seasons. Her final episode featured special guests including Jennifer Aniston, Billie Eilish, and Pink. She concluded her Q&A session by telling the audience that she was happy to make her return to comedy and bring some joy during a scary time to be alive. Said DeGeneres, "I think that we need more laughter and less drama." That was Ellen DeGeneres addresses aftermath of toxic workplace claims, and it was by Emlyn Travis. We heard last week about Pulp Fiction having a big anniversary, and here's an interesting article about John Travolta, and they linked the original review to Pulp Fiction, and I think it's a good read, so we'll get to that also. John Travolta landed Pulp Fiction by playing board games, doing Quentin Tarantino's finances. The actor spent nearly 24 hours with the director, during which they played board games inspired by Travolta's past projects. This is by Maureen Lee Lanker. It might seem like Vincent Vega was a role tailor-made for John Travolta, what with the dancing and all. But before he signed on to star in Pulp Fiction, Travolta spent a transformative day with writer-director Quentin Tarantino. It began when Travolta realized that Tarantino was living in his former Hollywood apartment and got weirder from there. During the Turner Classic Movies Film Festival's opening night 30th anniversary screening of the film, Travolta, joined by co-stars Uma Thurman, Harvey Keitel, and Samuel L. Jackson, reminisced about the meeting that rejuvenated his career. "I spent almost 24 hours with Quentin initially because I got a call from an agent that said, 'There's a new young director who made Reservoir Dogs and he's desperate to meet you. You're his favorite actor and he wants to do something with you,'" Travolta recalled during the conversation with TCM host Ben Mankiewicz. "So I went to his apartment on 1236 Crescent Heights Boulevard in Hollywood, and I said, 'This is very familiar.' And I knocked on his door, and I said, 'Don't say a word. If you go left, it's the living room and the kitchen is attached. If you go right, it's a bedroom.' He said, 'How do you know that?' And I said, 'I used to live here.' So we were off and running." The meeting was an opportunity for Tarantino to fulfill a lifelong fantasy: play board games based on several of Travolta's most famous projects with the man himself. It was the Saturday Night Fever game, the Grease game, the Welcome Back Kotter game, he said. Then Quentin said, "If we play it, just once in a while, I want you to throw out a line that you would have said, 'Up your nose with a rubber hose,' but don't tell me when you're going to do it." Travolta even struck his signature Saturday Night Fever disco pose as he explained how the game featured that iconic dance move as part of the spinning wheel's arrow. After their games, Travolta also decided to do a bit of a check-in on Tarantino, who was still a young and struggling creative. "I thought, okay, I don't know this boy, but I need to know how he's doing financially," he recalled. "So I went through his finances with him. I said, 'Okay, now you're an up-and-coming artist. You have to have some reserves. Tell me how much you have.' And I went through his whole accounting, and I felt a little better after that." Little did Travolta know that gesture would solidify him as Vincent Vega in Tarantino's mind. At the time, Tarantino was tossing around both From Dusk Till Dawn, which he co-wrote, and Pulp Fiction. He pitched both to Travolta, who gravitated much more strongly to Pulp. "A week later, he offered me the role of Vincent," Travolta concluded, "and I said, 'Why? What did you see in me that could convince you that I could play this role?' He said, 'It was you helping me with my finances. You had this analytical, theoretical, philosophical viewpoint that I need for that character.' He said, 'I want him to be thoughtful about whatever he's gone through.' And that was it." The annual Turner Classic Film Festival ran from April 18th to April 21st. And that was John Travolta landed Pulp Fiction by playing board games, doing Quentin Tarantino's finances, and it was by Maureen Lee Lanker. So let's take a look at that movie review for Pulp Fiction. This is by Owen Gleiberman, and this goes back to October 14th, 1994. Early on in Quentin Tarantino's Pulp Fiction, there's a transporting sequence in which veteran Los Angeles hitman Vincent Vega, played by John Travolta, takes Mia, played by Uma Thurman, the wife of his criminal boss, to Jack Rabbit Slim's, a faux 1950s diner so shiny and sprawling, it's like a mall out of your dreams. Vincent is supposed to be Mia's chaperone, but she's a cocaine-fueled party girl who keeps throwing him seductive looks, and this makes him a little nervous. According to legend, Mia's husband, the all-powerful Marcellus, played by Ving Rhames, had someone tossed off a balcony merely for giving Mia a foot massage. Friendly and slightly bloated with long, stringy black hair, Travolta still has his ingenuously goofy charisma, but he also lets us see that Vincent, a man of sharpened instincts, is making moves, doing everything in his power not to flirt. Before long, Mia announces that she wants to compete in the Jackrabbit Slim's dance contest. As the two begin twisting away on stage to Chuck Berry's You Never Can Tell, the dance becomes an extension of their dialogue. But what lifts the scene into the stratosphere is the way it taps our buried desire to see John Travolta dance again, to see his goofiness redeemed by swagger. You get the feeling that Tarantino staged this scene because he had to stage it. He's in thrall to the ecstasy, the pop delirium of the moment, and that's the sensation that courses through the entire movie. Watching Pulp Fiction, you don't just get engrossed in what's happening on screen. You get intoxicated by it, high on the rediscovery of how pleasurable a movie can be. I'm not sure I've ever encountered a filmmaker who combined discipline and control with sheer wild-ass joy the way that Tarantino does. For 2 hours and 35 minutes, we're drawn into the lives of violently impassioned underworld characters, hitmen, drug dealers, lethal vamps, who become figments of fury and grace and desire. We're caught up in dialogue of such fiendishly elaborate wit, it suggests a Martin Scorsese film written by Preston Sturges. In plot twists, they're closer to zigzags that are like whims bubbling up from the director's unconscious. Pulp Fiction is the work of a new style punk virtuoso. It is, quite simply, the most exhilarating piece of filmmaking to come along in the nearly 5 years I've been writing for this magazine. The movie is an amalgam of three stories, but the characters are overlapped in the ingenious, lapidary style of Robert Altman. It's really one big story, a pulp symphony in three movements. Tarantino even goes Altman one better. He overlaps the time frame. The first section, which centers on Vincent and Mia's night out, also features Vincent's partner Jules, played by Samuel L. Jackson. The two thugs entertain themselves by engaging in rapid-fire combative exchanges on every subject from McDonald's restaurants in Paris to the relative cleanliness of pigs and dogs. Tarantino's dialogue, with its densely propulsive, almost lawyerly fervor, its peppery comic blend of literacy and funk, has more snap and fight than most directors' action scenes. The laugh lines come bursting off the screen like shrapnel. Yet Tarantino also loves the intricate pleasures of narrative. In every scene of Pulp Fiction, he has devised a way to make us ask, what's going to happen next? The question emerges less from suspense movie trickery than from an intermingling of hope, dread, and fate, from Tarantino's vision of the world as a brightly colored existential playground. This notion is realized most spectacularly in the second episode, in which a palooka named Butch, played by Bruce Willis, having been ordered to throw a fight, wins it instead, then tries to escape with his European baby doll girlfriend, played by Maria de Medeiros. The scenes between these two have a piquant intimacy. It turns out, though, that the director is softening us for the kill, for Butch is soon plunged into a predicament so nightmarish, so deliriously lurid, that it has us reeling in shock, even as we're laughing at the bad boy audacity of Tarantino's vision. Willis, his emotions as exposed as his nearly shaved scalp, makes Butch a complexly sympathetic hero. Now dim, now brutal, now tender, now an avenging samurai returning to hell to save the man who'd sworn to kill him. The thrill and originality of Pulp Fiction is the way it shows us the characters acting far better than we expected in situations more threatening than we could have imagined. Coming after this, the third episode is like dessert, an outrageous black comic confection. We return to Vincent and Jules, who've accidentally splattered some kids' brains all over the inside of their car. Arriving in suburban LA, they're introduced to the Zen damage control efforts of Winston Wolfe, played by Harvey Keitel, a criminal fixer whose genius efficiency boils down to ordering the two of them to clean up the mess. The story plays out as a deviously logical extension of Goodfellas. It's a riff on the ways that even violent crime, in the banal detail of its execution, remains domestic. Holding everything together is Keitel's impeccably droll, dry-eyes performance. His delivery of the line, in which he tells Vincent and Jules not to congratulate each other just yet, he uses a phrase I can't begin to print here, is the movie's comic highlight. As superb as Travolta, Willis, and Keitel are, the actor who reigns over Pulp Fiction is Samuel L. Jackson. If you think his jerry-curled hair looks silly, the film is one step ahead of you. That hair is a tacit comic statement about the ghettoization of blacks in movies. Yet the joke is undercut by the raw ferocity of Jackson's performance. He just about lights fires with his gremlin eyes, and he transforms his speeches into hypnotic bebop soliloquies. Jules, the loquacious hitman, is the soul and spirit of Pulp Fiction. Fury reined in by order. During the final sequence, when he holds his gun on a scruffy thief and tells him, "You're the weak, and I'm the tyranny of evil men. But I'm trying really hard to be the shepherd." It's enough to give you a shiver. Here, in a flash, is the film's theme, the closet morality of scoundrels. In Pulp Fiction, Tarantino creates a dizzying spectacle of life at its darkest, only to release us with a wink into the light. That was the movie review Pulp Fiction from 1994. I can't believe that much time has gone by. And it was by Owen Gleiberman. Next, we have something about Jerry Seinfeld. He still thinks about a heckler from 30 years ago. That was a tough one. This is by Maureen Lee Linker. If you ever think you have trouble letting something go, don't worry, you're not the only one. In a new interview with Graham Bensinger, Jerry Seinfeld revealed that he still thinks about a heckler who got under his skin at a stand-up show all the way back in 1993. Yes, that's nearly 30 years ago. Seinfeld was doing a show in Boston, following Adam Sandler as his opener. "I had this amazing bit about weddings," he recalled. "It was fantastic. It was so long, it covered everything. And I worked on it and worked on it and worked on it. It takes me forever." Seinfeld explained how comedians sometimes spend years honing jokes, testing out bits, and refining them until they feel they've perfected something. "I start into the bit and somebody yells, 'Heard it!' he continued. And that was a tough one. I still think about it. It was mean. It was true. The comedian surmised that such a response may not happen as much today because audiences are perhaps more aware of the work that goes into building a comedy set. I think now audiences are a little more sophisticated, he says. These are pieces that we work on for months and months and months. You don't do it once and it works. Every scene you see in a movie, they did that 18 times. But one time, it was good. Same with comedy. I've done it 100 times. Now, I finally got it. Seinfeld had a wide-reaching conversation with Bensinger, delving into everything from his writing process to why he loves stand-up so much. Things happen on stage that do not happen anywhere else in life, he reflected. You're in hyperspace. The brain is sped up because you're in a fight or flight condition, which is what makes it so addictive. It's very adrenaline-fueled. The full interview debuts in broadcast syndication across the U.S. on the show In Depth with Gran Bensinger. It can also be found on Bensinger's YouTube channel. That was Jerry Seinfeld still thinking about a heckler from 30 years ago, and it was by Maureen Lee Lanker. Lopez vs. Lopez, tiny dog actor, was found on the streets before stardom. It's a wags to riches story. This is by Wesley Stenzel. Before canine star Noelle lit up the small screen as Churro on Lopez vs. Lopez, she was just another dog roaming the streets of Los Angeles. The dog's owner, Jubal Chen, works as an animal trainer for Gwynn's movie Menagerie and told People that she was handed a tiny pup during a shoot in downtown Los Angeles around Christmas 2017. Someone asked, "Is this one of your dogs?" Because we were doing a shoot down there, and we said, "No, but we'd take her and see if we could find her people," she explained. Scanning Noelle for an identifying microchip and putting up posters didn't reveal the dog's owner, so Chen adopted her herself. The new owner spent 6 months socializing and training Noelle to gauge her interest in show business. "She took a little bit because she was kind of skittish," Chen said. "She was a little worried about things. She's a little dog, so it's always a little more intimidating for little dogs because everything is bigger than you." After appearing in commercials and TV shows like Modern Family, Noelle now has a prominent role as the family dog Noelle on Lopez vs. Lopez. Chen said the dog is always excited to see her co-stars on set, including George Lopez and Mayan Lopez. "She likes to go there," Chen explained. "We get there and I take her out of the car and she's the first one at the stage door. She leads me to the stage door. I think she likes everybody saying hi to her. She gets to be the center of attention." Noelle now owns her star status on the set of Lopez vs. Lopez. "When she goes to set, she is a little diva," Chen says. "She'll walk onto set and wag her tail like she owns the place, and then people come and pet her and she acknowledges them without acknowledging them." Chen explained that the cast and crew on set try not to surprise Noelle with any unexpected behavior. "We protect her as much as we can so that she understands that everything is okay, and because she doesn't know that all of this isn't real. We make sure we rehearse and rehearse," Chen says. "If someone's going to come running into a room or scream or dance around and be silly, we like to be aware of that so we know it's going to happen, and then we show her that it's going to happen." Lopez and Lopez airs Tuesdays at 9 p.m. on NBC. This is a good time to take a break really quick here to say that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is Entertainment Weekly, and I'm reading from their website, which is EW.com. And for the last part of the show, I have the 25 best spy movies of all time, ranked. It's not all shaken martinis and gimmicky gadgets. This is by Dennis Perkins. And I am not going to get through all of these in the time that we have left. I'll read about as many as I can, and then I'll finish it next week. So there's your reason to come back already. When you think of spy movies, your mind likely envisions Daniel Craig in a tux or Tom Cruise hurling himself off something very high and dangerous. But the best espionage films run the gamut from moody procedurals to wrenching character studies, some of which interrogate the outright unglamorous lives of those secret agent types who choose covert surveillance and duty-bound betrayal over individual happiness. Don't worry, though. Even the most studious spies eventually have to engage in some action. Without dilly-dallying, here is Entertainment Weekly's ranking of the 25 best spy movies ever made and where to watch them. Number 25 is Mission Impossible from 1996. Tom Cruise has turned Ethan Hunt into his own personal, age-defying performance art project, relishing the chance to give stunt performers as much time off as possible. Here, his IMF lieutenant is thrust into leadership after a twist that pissed off fans of the original TV series to no end, gathering a squad to locate an undercover agent list before Vanessa Redgrave's baddie can get her hands on it. Along the way, director Brian De Palma keeps things moving with signature visual aplomb. A helicopter-train duel sets the tone for even more ludicrous Mission Impossible stunts to come, and the plot is merely a pretense to get from one crowd-popping spectacle to the next. We can watch Mission Impossible on Paramount Plus. Number 24, Pascali's Island from 1988. For some, albeit fictional, spies, the job is one of danger, seduction, and improbable gunplay. But for others, it's just a job, one more beset by boredom and disillusionment than exploding fountain pens and helicopter pursuits. For a lonely depiction of low-level espionage work, seek out James Dearden's Pascali's Island, in which Ben Kingsley plays a forgotten spy on a Greek island in the waning days of the Ottoman Empire, dutifully filing reports to his uncommunicative and far-off superiors. Pascali regards his pay as proof that his work is imperative. But the arrival of Charles Dance's mysterious Englishman sends Pascali into a tailspin of doubt about his purpose and his friendship with a beautiful Australian artist played by Helen Mirren. Soon it becomes clear that his earnest attempts at spycraft may have set a political disaster in motion. Kingsley is achingly vulnerable as the loyal little man whose devotion to an indifferent government costs him the only intimacy he's ever known. We can watch Pascali's Island on Tubi. Number 23 is True Lives from 1994. It's easy to chide Hollywood spy movie franchises like Mission Impossible for excess, but they've got nothing on James Cameron's ludicrously entertaining over-the-top comic action flick. Starring Arnold Schwarzenegger as a super spy improbably pulling off a double life and as an ordinary guy with his unknowing wife, played by Jamie Lee Curtis, True Lives bulges with heightened, well, everything. After missing yet another family event, to be fair, he was thwarting a nuclear threat by the dreaded Crimson Jihad, Arnold's Harry Tasker struggles to reconcile his wife's disillusionment with their marriage and prevent a terrorist plot against various major U.S. cities. With fine comic and physical turns from Curtis and Tom Arnold, True Lies is, in action craftsman Cameron's hands, a bombastic hoot. We can watch True Lies on Hulu. Number 22 is Bridge of Spies from 2015. Leave it to Steven Spielberg to find the bright side of espionage, as all-American icon Tom Hanks courageously leads a landmark Cold War prisoner exchange story co-written by the Coen brothers. It's not all rosy, of course, as Hanks's crusading attorney continually asserts the constitutional rights of Mark Rylance's captured Russian spy, something that Red Scare America regards as tantamount to treason. Rylance won an Oscar as mild-mannered minor agent Rudolph Abel, while Hanks, as real-life lawyer James B. Donovan, endures mounting suspicion for maintaining supposedly sacred American principles, facing career setbacks and death threats from his own countrymen. But it's in the meticulously created Checkpoint Charlie swap involving downed U.S. spy plane pilot Gary Powers that Spielberg shows off what a master filmmaker can do with a suspense sequence. We can watch Bridge of Spies on Apple TV+. Number 21 is Munich from 2005. Steven Spielberg proved he could also tap into the dark, violent side of spy movies 10 years before Bridge of Spies. See his gripping account of the real-life assassinations by Mossad after the 1972 Olympics terrorist attack in Munich that murdered 11 Israeli athletes. Eric Bana and Daniel Craig embark on a global search for the Palestinians responsible for the massacre, all the while battling assassins in their own tortured consciences. Both enemies prove to be equally dangerous, while Spielberg portrays the men as dutiful but conflicted instruments of national vengeance. Putting lauded director Spielberg at the service of such a politically and historically loaded incident is a recipe for controversy, something Munich reaped from all sides. While garnering Oscar nominations for Best Picture and Best Director, the film was assailed for being too soft on both ends of the Israel-Palestine conflict, and for turning the thorny subject matter into a more palatable morality tale about the nature of violence. Still, Munich's many suspense and action set pieces drive the story along with undeniable tension. We can watch Munich on Amazon Prime Video to rent. Number 20, Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1. That's from 2023. After six films spanning 27 years, the Mission Impossible franchise continued with this nearly three-hour-long installment. Part 2 is scheduled for summer 2025. Once more, Tom Cruise's Ethan Hunt is not so much a super spy as a superhero, while the now 61-year-old actor once again pushes the limits of what a fictional or, in Cruise's stunt person averse case, actual human being can withstand. Since long-running spy series are often signposts of our fears, Dead Reckoning's antagonist is a pernicious AI threatening the world's military and financial systems. Director Christopher McQuarrie, with nearly $300 million and a fanatically dedicated lead actor, pulls out every stop imaginable as the crew races across the globe, like when Hunt rides his motorcycle off a towering cliff and then parachutes onto a speeding train. There's a circular trajectory to Mission Impossible's brand of high-flying spy intrigue, given the filmmakers cited North by Northwest, also a major inspiration for the James Bond films, as influential to this franchise's thrills. Regardless, Dead Reckoning is the apotheosis of the big-budget spy blockbuster. We can watch Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1 on Paramount+. Number 19, The Bourne Supremacy in 2004. Matt Damon is the perfect actor to play Jason Bourne, an all-American soldier twisted into a pre-programmed, merciless killer by his own government. Damon's handsome blankness as the tortured Bourne, first seen floating amnesiac in the Mediterranean in 2002's The Bourne Identity, grounds the spy franchise's impeccably choreographed action with a leavening somberness. This first sequel is arguably the series' pinnacle, crafting a thrilling quest for revenge and redemption. After Paul Greengrass and his handheld cameras took the directing reins from Doug Liman, the Bourne supremacy asserted that happy endings are rarely in a spy's cards. Fans of the first film, or those familiar with the women in refrigerators cliché, might be upset at how a major character is dispatched to kick off the sequel. With Jason Bourne framed for a mysterious bombing and theft in Germany, it's up to Damon's still memory-deprived agent to hop the globe, utilizing the impressive muscle memory of every dirty espionage trick he was taught by a rogue CIA super assassin program in order to seek out the truth. The supporting cast remains stellar: Joan Allen, Brian Cox, Julia Stiles, Carl Urban. As Bourne navigates ingenious spy gambits, daring last-minute escapes, and some truly brutal fight scenes to reach his goal. The reveal of his true purpose only underscores the ugly toll of this international gamesmanship. On Amazon Prime Video to rent. Number 18, The Ipcress File from 1965. During the initial wave of James Bond mania, Michael Caine played a different sort of spy in 1965's The Ipcress File, but that was by design. Intended as a more ironic and downbeat alternative to the then burgeoning Bond franchise, this spy thriller from the novel by Len Deighton sees Caine as a dapper, lightly insubordinate, glasses-wearing British agent who uncovers clues to a conspiracy against the world's scientists. This Caine is something of a foodie, and the film was produced by Bond's Harry Stoltzman and scored by frequent Bond composer John Barry. But that's where Harry Palmer's similarities to 007 end. Cocky, cockney, and constantly beset by everyday duties, this, along with Alfie the following year, is the birth of Michael Caine as the everyman superstar. Dragooned into the service after a criminal past, Caine's Palmer disdains oppressive authority and regulation, even while proving himself a most capable sleuth and, when need be, efficiently violent. All the Cold War staples, brainwashing, torture, top-secret microfilm, are in play as Palmer, whom Caine portrayed in four additional films, doggedly proves his mettle against foes foreign and domestic. We can watch The Ipcress File. Oh, turns out we can't. It's not available to stream. Number 17 is Julia from 1977. The life of writer Lillian Hellman may seem like an odd inspiration for a suspenseful spy story, but this crackling drama delivers the goods. Following the playwright's, played by Jane Fonda's, career and relationship with detective novelist Dashiell Hammett, played by Jason Robards, Fred Zinnemann's film truly comes alive in the second half when Hellman goes to wartime Europe in search of her childhood friend Julia, played by a striking Vanessa Redgrave, whose own intellectual journey has turned her into an anti-fascist crusader. With the liberal but sheltered Hellman, herself later accused of un-American activities, making a dangerous voyage to Nazi Germany to supply Julia's World War II resistance colleagues with funds, Zinnemann pulls off one of the most tense and expertly performed sequences in spy movie history. After a horrifying scene in which fascists hurl academics over balconies, we watch as Julia walks Lillian through a terse exchange, with the duo's loving reunion taking the form of a high-wire act of perilous espionage. We can watch Julia on Google Play to rent. Ronin is number 16, and that's from 1998. Of course, spy movies aren't just about sad, shadowy men poring over microphones and microfiche. Sometimes it's about sad, shadowy men shooting it out over scenic French roadways in speeding cars, double crosses, and foot chases. This thriller from John Frankenheimer sees an aging and battle-worn action star in Robert De Niro encounter all of the above. De Niro plays a mercenary recruited to an international team by a mysterious Irish woman, played by Natasha McElhone, to track down and retrieve a specific metal attaché case. Ronan never gets around to telling us what's in the hotly contested suitcase, and that's the point. For all the assembled foot soldiers on every side, there's always a suitcase. Frankenheimer deploys his twists and a couple of all-time best car chases, like a devious puppet master, and De Niro, in one of his last great performances, keeps his character's true nature expertly under wraps until the film's final swerve. We can watch Ronan on Max. Number 15, Zero Dark Thirty from 2012. Like Munich, Catherine Bigelow's Oscar-nominated fact-based tale of terrorism and the revenge reaped as many accolades as it did, often contradictory, criticism. American intelligence agencies' hunt for Osama bin Laden is portrayed as a global manhunt, with Jessica Chastain's dogged CIA analyst chasing down sparse and scattered leads, even when they come from the euphemistically termed enhanced interrogation techniques used on suspects at black sites. Bigelow turns Chastain's obsession into a crackling detective story, complete with enough real-world intelligence-gathering gadgetry to put James Bond to shame. As the hunt gains momentum, a post-9/11 America's descent into graphically depicted torture remains an open moral question, with the stoic Chastain maintaining her singular pursuit of justice. Above all, Zero Dark Thirty is a riveting recreation of one of the most intense intelligence operations of all time, while its lack of cut-and-dried ethical stances speaks to the darkest side of the espionage game and human nature. We can watch Zero Dark Thirty on Stars. Number 14 is The 39 Steps from 1935. As cinema contends, there are vast intertwining networks of devious agents around us at all times. It's only natural that some of the best spy movies involve regular folks finding out things they're not supposed to. Such is the case in Alfred Hitchcock's template-setting spy drama, The 39 Steps, which sees two very different people face constant and entertaining peril in a pre-World War II English countryside teeming with spies lurking in unexpected places. An innocent man, played by Robert Donat, drags an even more innocent bystander, played by Madeline Carroll, into his escape from a network of spies after some top-secret information falls into his hands. The two naturally fall for each other. Their enforced intimacy was pretty racy for the time, but not without Hitchcock putting them into some deliciously sticky situations, leading to a still sensational finale at the London Palladium. We can watch The 39 Steps on Tubi. On Her Majesty's Secret Service from 1969. George Lazenby's sole outing as 007, which came between Sean Connery's fifth and sixth films, goes above and beyond to distinguish itself as an utterly unique entry in Britain's premier espionage franchise, injecting a welcome helping of grit and heart into the proceedings. It's the first and, for most of the character's history, the only Bond movie to add genuine emotional vulnerability to its central super spy, allowing him to fall in love with the romantic lead rather than cast her aside as another one-night stand. On Her Majesty's Secret Service, sees Bond called to protect Contessa Teresa Tracy De Vincenzo, played by Diana Rigg, the daughter of a prominent criminal overlord who helps him track down Ernest Blofeld, played by Telly Savalas, and Spectre's biological warfare operation in the Swiss Alps. As his affection for the Countess blossoms, we're treated to a more complicated, well-rounded vision of the agent, which makes sense given that the relationship was possibly inspired by Ian Fleming's real-life tragic romance during World War II. Additionally, the snowy action sequences, including chaotic downhill skiing and slippery car chases on ice, are among the very best in Bond history. We can watch On Her Majesty's Secret Service on Max. Number 12, The Quiet American from 2002. A genre giant gets a deceptively muted adaptation in this Vietnam-set drama based on Graham Greene's novel, who, like Frederick Forsyth and John le Carré, is a veteran of the intelligence service MI6. The film, while nominally a love triangle, gradually reveals itself as another instance of empathy and espionage colliding. Michael Caine plays a sodden British journalist during the 1950s occupation of what was then known as French Indonesia. Losing his much younger Vietnamese lover, played by Duthi Hai Hien, to an American undercover operative, played by Brendan Fraser, outstanding as the brash embodiment of U.S. anti-communist foreign policy, leads the seen-it-all Caine to finally play the spy game with tragic results. It's Caine's movie, as his dissolute reporter's confused tangle of self-interest and world-weariness sows the seeds of his quietly devastating story. We can watch The Quiet American on Amazon Prime Video to rent. Number 11 is The Day of the Jackal from 1973. Frederick Forsyth is another all-time great spy writer, and his fictionalized version of the 1962 assassination attempt on French President Charles de Gaulle from within France's military forms the backbone of this icy, meticulous thriller. Like le Carré, Forsyth was an associate of MI6 as a longtime unpaid informant. The journalist used his investigative skills to craft this story about the fallout from Gaulle granting independence to colonial Algeria, which put him in the merciless crosshairs of a paid killer. A little-known actor at the time, Edward Fox is impeccable as the Jackal, an assassin hired by the right-wing group OAS to gun down the president. There's nothing flashy or even passionate about this spy. He's a surgically sharp instrument, assuming various disguises and dodging the several intelligence services on his quest to fulfill his contract. Michael Lonsdale matches the Jackal as the French cop tasked with thwarting the rumored assassination. When Fox's Jackal kills, it's out of pragmatism. When Lonsdale's detective succeeds, it's because his methods are similarly dispassionate and tenacious. Thus, the film's white-knuckle finale boils down to a minuscule misstep, one that reveals how espionage is vulnerable, even to a grain of sand. We can watch The Day of the Jackal on Amazon Prime Video to rent. That is a really good list. That leaves us with the top 10. So I'm going to finish this article, which is the 25 best spy movies of all time, ranked. It's by Dennis Perkins. We've read the first 15. I will do the next and best 10, according to their ranking, in our next show. And I don't mention this often enough, so I'll wrap up this episode with a refresh on how you can listen to old shows if you want to, because next week you might want to do that to refresh on what we did this week. by going to sunsounds.org, the website. As soon as it comes up, you can click on the broadcast info and audio button. That's right underneath the donate button. And then you can go down to the section called programming links. You can listen live from there if you want to. There's also a link for on-demand podcasts. Once you click that, it will take you to the list of all the podcasts or previous episodes that have been aired recently. And if you scroll down, you can get to the entertainment section, which includes Entertainment Weekly, among many others. That does wrap up the time we have for the episode this week. Please come back next week to hear the final of that spy article, but also to hear what other items Entertainment Weekly has for us. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thank you for listening this week. And until next week, goodbye.